Judges chapter 14. There we go. So we're looking at Samson. Remember, there's no P in that name. Okay? Samson, not Samson. I'm going to back up here. Last week, we kind of ended with this thought. No, too far. All right, here we go. I don't usually go backward. I usually go forward. So a lot of times we think of Samson as somebody that looked like this, you know, when the reality is Samson probably looked like this. You know, because everybody looked at him and was like, well, what's the secret of your strength? How does this happen? Where does this come from? You know, so we tend to think of Samson as like a cartoon superhero. I mean, in one instance, he lifted city gates and carried them, and he did this and he did that. The reality is he just looked like an ordinary guy that God used in an extraordinary way. So Judges chapter 14, we left off with the story about in the first four verses, he demanded that his parents get him a Philistine wife. And then verse 5 is about where we left off. Samson went down, his father and his mother, to Timnath and came to the vineyards of Timnath, and behold, a young lion roared against him. And the Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon him, and he rent him as he would have rent a kid, and he had nothing in his hand, but he told not his father or his mother what he had done. He went down and talked with the woman, and she pleased Samson well. So it seems in verse 5 when it says the family went down, it's as though they went down to meet this woman and to make an arrangement. Okay, so he wants her, he's demanded her in a very respectful and deferent fashion, get her for me to wife. And so now parents are going down, and apparently they came to some sort of arrangement, because in verse 8 it says, after a time he returned to take her. So it seems like they had come to an arrangement, and then he went home for a period of time, and he's coming back at the designated time for the wedding. But it says here in verse 5 that a young lion roared against him, and then later it says he didn't tell his parents. So it seems like, you know, while they were generally traveling together, he had turned aside, taken a side road for whatever reason. Now, was this because, you know, he got lost? Was this because he was walking faster than they? Was he just kind of prone, like one of those people that's like, I don't want to take the main road, I'm going to find a new road? You know people like that? Some of you are people like that. I'm just going to explore and find a new way to get there. I go back home now. I go back to, you know, mom and dad's house, but it was home where I grew up. And my sister's like, oh yeah, well you can just take this road, this road, this road, this road. And I'm like, you know, time out. It's been, you know, basically 30 years since I lived here. Once I went to college, I was home for 3 weeks every summer and a couple of weeks at Christmas. I mean, I kind of recognize the names you're saying, but I don't remember where those roads are at all. But my sister's philosophy is, if there's another way, why would I go on the interstate, pretty much? I'm just like, give me the straight path most of the time. But anyway, maybe he was one of those people. Don't know, but he got separated from mom and dad. The term here in verse 5 says it was a young lion that roared against him. And it's interesting because this young lion, usually lions roar when they're hungry, when they're hunting, that kind of thing. This lion was, this was a separate word. There's a different word for lion's whelp, which would be a real small baby that mom's still taking care of. This was bigger, apparently, you know, somewhat self-sufficient, but not a fully grown adult lion, leader of the pack kind of thing. Also, if you have, you know, the pictures going in your head, much more likely that this would have been a mountain lion and not an African lion, okay? So not, you know, the big brown mane, you know, or beard or whatever they call it, you know, I don't know. But that's, at least that's what I think, okay? I mean, Israel is adjacent to Africa. I mean, Egypt is North Africa, very northern part. It's possible they went back and forth, but if it's a naturally occurring thing, it's probably a little bit more like that. But nonetheless, mountain lion, African lion, angry dog. I don't want to meet it, you know, on a dirt path somewhere, you know. But this says this young lion roared against him. Now remember, in their circumstance, they were well armed and equipped for every circumstance, true or false? Okay, parallel idea in 1 Samuel chapter 13 tells us, let's see if I had the reference written down here. But anyway, it was 1 Samuel 13 where it tells us that the Philistines had confiscated all the weapons, 13:20. You know, in fact, in this would have been later on in the time of Saul, but it was the same general circumstance where they didn't even have a file. If they wanted to sharpen their plow or sharpen their axe, they had to go to a Philistine shop, you know, Philistine blacksmith to do it. And I'm sure they were charged fair and reasonable rates for that service. So the point is they were not allowed to have weapons. He didn't have a sword. You know, he didn't have what we would think of as weapons of war. So he had his hands. Verse 6, it says, the Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon him, and he rent him as he would have rent a kid. This phrase here, came mightily upon him, has the idea of to rush. When it's used of the Spirit of the Lord, it's the idea of a instantaneous or a sudden possession or moving kind of thing. It was just in a flash, you know, the Spirit of the Lord empowered him to do something significant here. And it says he rent him as he would have rent a kid. Now, I don't know about you. Any of you rented a kid lately? Okay. This word rent, I mean, we don't use it the same way now, but this is the past tense of the verb rend, R-E-N-D, okay, which means to tear. But interestingly, this word means even in English, Webster's 1828, of the English word to rend, R-E-N-D, is to separate a substance into parts with force or sudden violence. So it's not like, okay, I'm going to delicately try to work these things apart so that I can preserve them. It's what you do when you're upset or, you know, you got something and you don't want to hear it. You know, that fast, almost violent tearing. You know, I would do it with individual sheets of paper. Esther would do it with entire phone books, you know. But that's the idea. Is to tear with violence, okay? Obviously, he did this with his hands because he was not allowed to have a weapon. It says he rent him as he would have rent a kid. The contrast is interesting, right? What's attacking him? A lion. By contrast, a kid, a baby goat, which is going to be far more gentle, docile, while they can be, you know, cantankerous like any youngin. It's not the same level as you'd have with a young lion, right? But he dealt with this lion as he would have with a baby goat. So you got this comparatively docile and gentle animal and a attacking fierce lion, and he dealt with them in the same way. Now, does this mean that the normal manner of slaughtering goats was to grab them with your hands and rip them in half? I don't think so, okay? I think the idea is that this fierce attacking animal was treated as a non-threatening, docile kind of a threat, if you will, or an obstacle. It says he had nothing in his hand. Verse 6, he told not his father or his mother what he had done. Now, I don't know. I mean, some commentators want to give him the benefit of the doubt that, you know, the Spirit of the Lord came on him and it just seemed normal to him and, you know, he didn't think anything of it. You know, others want to give him credit for being humble. The more we read about Samson, that's kind of unlikely. Okay? I mean, there's another possibility here, and that is that he didn't communicate well with his parents. Right? I mean, he didn't necessarily tell his parents he'd go into Timnath. He comes back and says, hey, I was in Timnath. I saw this woman. Get her for me to wife. And then later on, when he goes to tell the riddle and his bride says, you haven't told me. He's like, I didn't tell my parents either. So maybe he just didn't communicate well with his parents, right? Nonetheless, he just didn't tell them what was going on. Verse 7, and he went down and talked with the woman, and she pleased Samson well. Verse 8, and after a time he returned to take her, and he turned aside to see the carcass of the lion, and behold, there was a swarm of bees and honey in the carcass of the lion. So as I mentioned before, verse 8, after a time he returned to take her, seems to indicate that they'd come to an arrangement. Now, if you just look at this passage here, It seems like maybe the arrangement was just made with the Philistine woman. Okay? So, you know, and it does seem that culturally it was a little bit different with the Philistine women than maybe with the Jewish women. But if you go into the next chapter, you see that, you know, when Samson got over being angry at everything that had happened, her dad was like, no, I gave her to somebody else. So, I mean, the dad was involved somehow. Okay, but all we're told here in chapter 14 is they talked with the woman. So did they just make an arrangement with her? Did they make an arrangement with her parents? You know, that detail is left out, but the likelihood is it was, you know, the parents working something out. Okay, verse 8, he turned aside to see the carcass of the lion. And behold, there was a swarm of bees and honey in the carcass of the lion. Now, I'm not a beekeeper expert. But, you know, and from what I understand, this is, you know, desert climate, so it would not necessarily take a super long time for the carcass to either deteriorate or to, you know, be scavenged by other animals. But how long does it take bees to build a hive and produce honey? You know, is that a one-week process? You know, two-week process? I mean, I legitimately don't know. I mean, what is the length of time under normal circumstances it would take for bees to produce enough honey that you could take the honeycomb and eat some? Any beekeepers here? I don't know the fancy word for it. I'm sure there's a, you know, $10 word for beekeeper. Okay. But the point is it wasn't like this was a week that passed. All right. There's a little bit of time in between. But when he goes back down for the wedding, I'm going to go see what happened to that lion. And bees had built a nest there, and there was a honeycomb and honey. And he took it, verse 9. He took thereof in his hands and went on eating, and he caught up, he came to his father and mother, and he gave them, and they did eat, but he told them not that he'd taken the honey out of the carcass of the lion. Now, I mean, to me, this is somewhat impressive on different levels. You know, he obviously didn't have the same beekeeping suits that we have today. Did he have something to puff smoke to kind of distract the bees? That's what beekeepers do a lot today, as I understand it. I don't know. But he managed to take the honeycomb and the honey and get out of there without being stung to death by all the bees. And, I mean, this reminds me of the story in, I think it's 1 Samuel 14, where there's a battle and Saul says, nobody eats today, you know, so I can be avenged of my enemies. And Jonathan wasn't with him because Jonathan's the one that started the whole deal. And Jonathan found a honeycomb and he ate it. And he's like, my dad said, what? That was dumb. I ate this and look, I got energy and I'm better able to fight. Well, anyway, kind of the same thing here, I guess. But he told his mom and he didn't tell his mom and dad that he took it out of the carcass of the lion. Now, normal circumstances, this is just kind of whatever. Okay, if you're brave enough to go harvest your own honey, then you get the reward. If not, you know, you go hungry. But is there anything particular related to Samson's situation here that could be problematic? Matthew, what are you thinking there? Right. You're exactly right. Not touching a dead body was one of the prohibitions for a Nazirite vow. Okay? In fact, you know, it kind of gets down to you can't even do this for your father or your mother kind of thing. So, touching a dead body was not keeping the circumstances of Nazirite vow. Marrying a Philistine woman was, I'm sure, it would be included in Nazirite. I mean, that was included in the Mosaic law for all of Israel, not just those with a Nazirite vow, right? But, so that's a problem number one of many with Samson, okay? He apparently had little regard for many aspects of his Nazirite vow. Verse 10, so his father went down unto the woman, and Samson made there a feast. You see the phrase here, for so used the young men to do. So, there were customs, you know, in that time. Now, was this a Jewish custom or a Philistine custom? That's kind of interesting. Who gave the, in Jewish culture, you know, the groom would show up and then they go back to their house and, you know, have the feast and all of that. But If you remember when Jacob tried to marry Rachel and ended up getting Leah, who gave the feast? The bride's father. You know, the bride's family. So, I mean, it's different times. Abraham's family, which Jacob would have been his grandson. Different times, you know, sometimes the bride's family gave the feast, sometimes the groom's family. We have our own customs and traditions in America on that. I mean, how does that differ in Brazil? Is it groom's family, bride's family? Is that the way it was when y'all were there, the bride's family? Okay. You know, so, I mean, we all have our own customs, but here, apparently the groom's family gave the wedding feast here. Verse 11, it came to pass when they saw him that they brought 30 companions to be with him. Okay? The idea of the word brought there is to take. You know, they selected 30 companions. Who's the they? It had to be the bride's family or, you know, her fellow citizens there. So he showed up by himself and they're like, this isn't the way we do it. You need a wedding party. So they selected 30 attendants for him. We would call this today groomsmen, bridesmaids. You know, this in some shape, form, or fashion has been common at weddings, you know, for a very long time throughout human history. But they selected 30 companions. Now, that term companions, it's kind of speaking loosely, I think. I mean, companions. You think about that, you think about something in common or spending some time together. I mean, as far as we know, when's the first time Samson met these fellas? Can you imagine showing up for the wedding rehearsal and you actually meet the groomsmen there? I mean, if you're the pastor doing the service, that makes some sense, right? If you're the groom, that makes less sense to me. But, you know, he met them at the wedding. Now, this was a wedding feast of 7 days long and all of that. But he has 30 companions. Now, I mean, that's just excessive, is it not? 30 bridesmaids. You know, you try to get a small handful, even if they're all related, you know, sisters or cousins, if they're all related to the bride, to agree on dresses for the wedding, right? 30. Oh, my stars. You know, that's just excessive. But nonetheless, that's what they did. 30 companions. Verse 12, and Samson said unto them, I will now put forth a riddle unto you. If ye can certainly declare it to me within 7 days of the feast and find it out, then I will give you 30 sheets and 30 changes of garments. But if ye cannot declare it me, ye shall give me 30 sheets and 30 change of garments. And they said, put forth thy riddle that we may hear it. What would we call this today? Short word, three letters, starts with a B. A bet. I'll bet you 30 changes of garment you can't figure out my riddle. So you got gambling going on at the wedding reception here. You know that Samson's a great spiritual leader, is he not? So now, is this the way that you would treat your close friends? Maybe, but not usually. Now, how confident did Samson have to be to bet? If they lost, they each had to provide one change of clothes. If he lost, he had to provide 30. I mean, the odds are pretty stacked against Samson at that point, right? He had to be very confident in his riddle. Now, the term sheets and changes of raiment, the term sheets is a point of argument for the commentators that want to minor on the minutia. The term sheets, if you just look up that word in the lexicon, it has the idea of an outer garment. It could be decorative or it could be, you know, the main outer garment, but it has the idea of an outer garment. You know, some have, the ones that want to argue about it, want to make it as though this was more of a, like what we would call a Sunday suit or a military dress uniform or something like that. And so the sheet would have been the girdle or the belt that would hold the weaponry and stuff. And then the change of garment would have been the suit itself. Nonetheless, it does seem to have been nicer things and not just, you know, work jeans and a t-shirt. But this would have been, you know, a more expensive and special occasions kind of suit of clothes. But he says, you're going to give me 30 changes of garments and 30 sheets if you can't solve my riddle. Verse 13, they said, put forth thy riddle that we may hear it. In other words, they said, you're on. We'll take your bet. Verse 14, and he said unto them, out of the eater came forth meat, and out of the strong came forth sweetness. Now, because we know the story, I'm like, oh yeah, okay, I get it. You know, great, great riddle. But these terms are fairly generic, right? Out of the eater, what kind of things eat? All right, it's Sunday school. I'm looking for a little feedback from you. What kind of things eat? Kids, that's what I was thinking. Yeah, teenagers. Yeah. Everything. I mean, this could be everything from bugs and worms to T-Rex, if we're going by size. If we're going by volume consumed, you know, everything from insects to teenagers. You know, that would be on the top end of the consumption scale, right? What eats? Everything. Bugs, worms, insects, small animals, medium-sized animals, large animals, you know, people, birds, you know, all kinds of things eat. Okay? Out of the eater came forth meat. And this term meat here is a generic term. I mean, when we use the term meat today, we're thinking flesh. Okay? But this term, just like, you know, in the New Testament, where Jesus said, I have meat to eat that you know not of. My meat is to do the will of him that sent me. The idea is, you know, sustenance, food. But it was used generically. This term here could be flesh, it could be bread, it could be grains or vegetables or whatever. Okay? Out of the eater came forth meat, and out of the strong came forth sweetness. Okay, so eater and strong, this is kind of that Hebrew parallelism. It's kind of expanding on a little bit. But again, out of the strong, the idea of strength, and then sweetness. Could that be like sweetness of disposition, gentleness, or is it something sweet to eat? See, these terms are generic enough that this was a fantastic riddle. Okay? It was true, all the pieces were there, but if you ever, any of you ever do, you know, like Sudoku or, you know, word puzzles, you know, on your, I was going to say on your app, you know, maybe in the newspaper if they still print those. You know, buy the crossword puzzle book at the store. I mean, there's a lot of times, especially on apps, you can choose your level, right? Easy, medium, or difficult. Okay, this is not the easy and medium, right? This is like expert level difficult when it comes right down to it. Because while all the pieces were there and it was true and all of that, this was such an unusual situation. It was not something they're like, oh yeah, you know, what is orange and conical shaped and comes up every summer? I mean, that's the easy level, right? What are we talking about? Construction cones, okay? in some places, that's called the state flower because they come up every spring, right? But you know, that would be on the easy level. This one is like top level difficult. Okay? This happened on the first day of the feast. The end of verse 14 says they could not in 3 days expound the riddle. Verse 7, it came pass on the seventh day, they said to his wife, entice thy husband that he may declare unto us the riddle, lest we burn thee and thy father's house with fire. Have you not called us to take what we have? Is it not so? Verse 16, Samson's wife wept before him and said, thou dost but hate me and lovest me not. Thou hast put forth a riddle to the children of my people and hast not told it me. And he said, behold, I've not told my father or my mother. Shall I tell it thee? Verse 17, she wept before him the 7 days while their feast lasted, and it came to pass on the seventh day that he told her. All right, so in typical Hebrew writer fashion, the story is not necessarily given in chronological order. Okay, to me, this is not the way I would write it. It'd be like day one, day two, day three, day four, day five. They would tell this piece of the story, then tell this piece of the story, and then tell this piece of the story, and maybe they're holding the punchline, or maybe just... But it says here very clearly in verses 15 through 17 that his wife leaned on him, pressed him, the entire 7 days of the feast. Well, here in end of verse 14, it says they could not in 3 days expound the riddle. I think, you know, maybe it was her own curiosity, but I don't think they waited till the seventh day. I think at best they spent 3 days trying to figure it out. On the fourth day, they went to her and said, "You better help us." Did you catch in the reading of that the us and them? Who's the us? Philistines. Who's the them? The Israelites. Who did the 30 companions assume that the bride would side with? The Philistines. Us and them. And even in there he said, "You brought him here to take everything that we've got. Is it not so?" Isn't that true? Well, you know, they were angry. They didn't want to lose. They didn't want to have to pay up. All of those things. I mean, there's an easy way not to lose a bet. Don't make a bet, you know. My lifetime winnings on gambling are zero. So are my lifetime losses. It works out, you know. I come out ahead of most gamblers. But, you know, I think at most they went 3 days trying to figure it out on their own. By no later than the fourth day. Now, it says she leaned on him the entire 7 days. Maybe they went to her the first day and says, "Hey, do you know what this is? You got to help us here." But definitely by the middle of the feast, they're kind of ramping it up. A fantastic riddle. And you can imagine that Samson is very deferent and humble and demure about this during the 7 days of the feast, right? If we know anything about Samson, that's the opposite of his character. Guarantee you, he's giving them smirks and little verbal jabs. You boys figure it out yet? We have. We're just waiting for the end of the feast. You're not off the hook yet, Samson. You know? But then what happens? By verse 15, on the seventh day, they said to Samson's wife, "Entice thy husband that he may declare unto us the riddle, lest we burn thee and thy father's house with fire. Have you not called us to take what we have? Is it not so? I thought you called us to a feast. You called us to rob us." If these are your friends, you need new friends. You don't need enemies. If your friends are going to burn your house down on top of your head. Okay? Verse 16, Samson's wife wept before him. Some things are as old as time, are they not? She wept. Here come the tears. Here comes the pleas. "Thou dost but hate me and lovest me not." You said you love me. You really hate me. All right, what period are we in here? I mean, this is the wedding feast. This is the start of the honeymoon. You hate me. I don't know. I don't think that's how Samson kind of envisioned this thing going, do you? That's not what we would call a honeymoon, right? His wife's crying and upset. That's not the way that a honeymoon's supposed to go. "Thou dost hate me and lovest me not, and you put forth a riddle unto the children of my people, and you didn't even tell me." I mean, she may have a small point there, but she's pulled out the tears. She's pulled out the manipulation. She's pulled out the leverage and all, every button that she knows how to push. She's pushing. I think the end of verse 16 is very instructive. "I didn't tell my mom and dad. Why am I going to tell you? I've known them longer than I've known you." This wedding is off to a great start. They should have done more with premarital counseling, right? Should have gone to see Dr. Love for premarital counseling. Maybe they wouldn't have got to this situation, right? "I didn't tell my mom and dad. I'm not telling you either." All right, then what happens? Verse 17, "She wept before him the 7 days of the feast while their feast lasted. And it came to pass on the seventh day that he told her, because she lay sore upon him." Wow. I mean, now, ladies, I think I could understand it if you think your mom and dad and your brothers and sisters are going to get killed if you don't figure this out. I mean, I could understand doing what you got to do, right? She must have believed that these guys would really do it. But, you know, this is just a horrible way to start a marriage. But 7 days, she's laying on him, you know, alternating between charm and threats, you know, back and forth. In verse 7, it says, on the seventh day, he told her because she lay sore upon him. She wore him down. He finally, all right, woman, that's enough. And she told him. What'd she do? She turned around the end of verse 17. She told the riddle to the children of her people, loyal to her husband, loyal to her new family. She goes and tells her Philistine neighbors and betrays her husband. Boy, this marriage is off to a great start, is it not? Verse 18. The men of the city said unto him on the seventh day before the sun went down, what is sweeter than honey? And what is stronger than a lion? Ding, 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 ding. Correct answer. Samson's response. And he said unto them, if you had not plowed with my heifer, you had not found out my riddle. Oh, man. I love that phrase. Okay, it's not one that you can use without getting yourself into trouble, but it's hilarious. I mean, the term plow is to unearth something that was hidden by dirt, right? And then he used that sweet term of endearment that is still used to this day. You plowed with my heifer. I'm just telling you, fellas, you know, call her a heifer. See how well it goes for you. I'm not even sure a cow farmer can get away with that, much less any of us. If you had not plowed with my heifer, you had not found out my riddle. Okay, what's he done? Well, I mean, he's called them out. He's insulted his wife, but at the same time, she's betrayed him. So what all's going on here? You have a wedding that he demanded because of the lust of his eyes, and now they gave him Philistine companions that he should have never had to start with. And then you got this bet back and forth between him, and his wife's manipulating him and crying, and the whole thing's a disaster, and he's just fed up with it. And so he tells her, and she tells them. It's like, I've had it! Now, in one sense, he didn't have to be at that spot, you know, if he wasn't shopping for brides down in Timnath and Philistine territory anyway. And we know earlier in the chapter said the Lord was going to use this as an occasion against the Philistines. And what does he do? He gets angry and he goes out and he kills Philistines to pay off the bet. But nothing about this is anything like, you know, fill in the blank. Take Samuel. His life wasn't like that. You know, take Nathan. You know, you take the other judges and prophets. I mean, honestly, in some ways, Samson was more like Eli's sons than Samuel, wasn't he? But, you know, what Samson thought was going to be a great thing turned into a terrible thing. The whole thing blew up. He leaves in a rage. And, you know, he finds he pays off the debt by murder. We'll have to talk about that next week because our time's up. But understand this, you don't have to resort to Philistine methods to get God's work done. I mean, God used Samson, but these same things could have been accomplished other ways. Okay? And that's one of, I think, the major lessons that we see as we go through and look at Samson. Lord, thank you for your word. Help us to be open. Help us to learn. Help us to see tendencies of ourselves if they are here in these lessons. And Lord, I pray that you help us to benefit from it. Now we pray your blessing on the preaching hour to come. In Jesus' name, amen. You're dismissed.